Father, thanks for the chance to gather and to hear your voice in the middle of a day. And wherever we're coming from, please help us to tune in to what you have for us and to benefit from it. Amen. It's such a joy to see familiar faces and to be back. And I think this is a great place, great topic for us to digest as well. So just to bring you up to speed, we're in the Old Testament, Book of Daniel. Daniel's got three friends who have refused to do what they were asked to do, which is bow down to a golden statue. And there's a despot, tyrannical king called Nebuchadnezzar, and this is how he responds. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three friends. He ordered the furnace heated seven times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. We're going to come back to that in a little while. Many of us will know the name John Humphreys, BBC journalist. He publicly described his journey out of Christian faith once like this. He said, "I had an unquestioning belief in God. I suppose in the end what finally destroyed it for me was the presence of so much suffering. It's the classic thing. This is hardly original. I'm very conscious of that. It's very cliched, but nonetheless very real. When Beslan happened, and that was a massacre of nearly 200 children at a school in Chechnya that he was reporting on, when Beslan happened, that was, I suppose, a final straw." And as John Humphrey says, this route out of Christian faith is a pretty well-trodden path for this reason. And you may have observed it or experienced it yourself, and often the logic behind it goes something like this. Either God is all-powerful and could get rid of suffering but chooses not to, in which case he's not all good, or he's all good and wants to get rid of all suffering but he just can't because he's not all-powerful. But either way, the suffering means that we cannot believe in the God of Christianity who claims to be both all-good and all-powerful. And therefore, that logic means a lot of people just abandon belief in God when life hurts. I want to suggest today that hard as these issues are, there is a much better response than that. Firstly, the problem with that line of reasoning is that it assumes that if I can't immediately imagine a good reason why God might allow something, there cannot be one. I've got four daughters, and on multiple occasions I've been the one who's had to take a one-year-old for a vaccination, and partly because my wife hates doing it and I get lumbered with the job. It's quite a traumatic experience if you've ever done it. A lot of, you can imagine, needle and a lot of screaming. And it's a different kind of scream from a baby's normal scream. There's the scream of pain, which you're used to, but there's also, there's a few nods, this scream of betrayal. Daddy, you knew what was coming and you were passive through it all. I thought up till now you'd been on my side. And there's a kind of anger, a disappointment in their tone. You can't yet explain to them what is going on. And so what you're left with is you have to just give them a cuddle and hope that they can grasp that even though they don't get everything yet, they still know that Daddy loves them and it's going to be okay. I think it's a little bit like that with us and God. Just because I don't immediately understand why every situation is permitted doesn't mean there cannot be a good reason for it. Because I think most of us, even with just a little bit of perspective, we can see good reasons for at least some of the pain in the world. So why couldn't it be possible that from God's vantage point, there are good reasons for all of it? So as we approach this topic, I'm just encouraging a little bit of humility as we come up to it. And actually, I want to suggest that abandoning belief in God doesn't really help us with this very real question that wells up in us, the why of suffering. This is something C.S. Lewis discovered. The writer, he lost his mother when he was very young. And he decided at an early age, a little bit like John Humphreys, that therefore there could not be a God because of all the suffering in the world. But very publicly and famously, later in life, C.S. Lewis switched from his atheism to Christianity. And he wrote a book called Mere Christianity, where he says this: "My argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? Of course, I could have just given up my idea of justice by saying that that was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it didn't happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turned out to be too simple." Now, if you haven't heard that before, that's quite a few steps in there. So I'm going to try and repeat the argument, but in a different way. He's saying basically, if there is no God and all we have is nature, then what is more natural than violence and suffering? And we see it all around us, don't we? The strong eat the weak. What then is wrong with that? From an atheistic perspective, we might have feelings that violence and suffering is wrong, but of course that's all they are. They're just feelings. Without God, we don't have an objective basis outside ourselves for objecting to them. And my point here is just to say that abandoning belief in God doesn't really help us with this very real question, the why of suffering. For other people, it's not so much this kind of philosophical question, but it's a very practical question. Perhaps you haven't abandoned belief in God altogether, but you just feel after what's happened, you can't really trust God anymore. One father has written this about his experience. "On July the 4th, my multiply disabled son entered the world, and the world came crashing down around me, and would soon include a deep and intense bitterness towards God. I never denied that God existed or is powerful. I concluded that he was mean and capricious and that I couldn't trust him." And I want to suggest that if that experience, that kind of experience, hasn't happened to us already, it will be just a matter of time before we experience something very painful, something that is seemingly pointless, and that we're forced with this question in a very personal way. Well, where is God when it hurts? And we're faced with this question not philosophically so much as a very real, practical and personal one. And so what I want to do today is to pass on from the Bible two things we need to grasp, vital things, two anchors that we need in place so that when the storm hits, we can not only endure the storm, but we can even find joy and hope in the middle of it. And those two anchors, I put them on the sheet, are the cross of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus. So first, let's think about the cross, which I've put there, tells us that God cares. We had read at the beginning that famous story from Daniel about Daniel's friends thrown into the fire. We're told that the furnace was so hot in verse 22 that even the soldiers who threw them in got turned into toast. And yet the comfort of this wonderful passage, and it's been a comfort for believers over hundreds of years, is that when King Nebuchadnezzar peers into the fire, one assumes, you know, from a pretty safe distance, he says, verse 24, did we not cast three men into the fire? And then verse 25, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. And the point of this extra figure in the furnace is to communicate loudly and clearly that when we ask the question, where is God? One of the wonderful answers the Bible gives us is that for those who trust him, God is right there. He's with us. He's standing alongside us in the midst of the worst of trials. And what a comfort that is. We even discover that he uses our trials for good. But it doesn't always feel that way. And we think, well, how can I be sure? And the Bible's clearest answer to that is the cross of Jesus. And not until we get to the cross in the Bible's storyline do we realize just how far our God has gone to be with us in trials. The writer John Stott said this, I could never myself believe in God if it were not for the cross. In the real world of pain, how could one worship a God who was immune to it? But of course, Christianity uniquely proclaims this God who has chosen to become vulnerable to pain. And so that means that if we're a victim of injustice, God says, I know what it is to be falsely accused and tortured. Or if things have got so bad for us that we're just crying out, why? Why, God? And then we see Jesus strung up on a Roman cross crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus understands our suffering and he is with us in it. And yet actually Jesus came to do much more than that. And I'll try and explain it. I'm reading a biography at the moment about a guy called Hugh Latimer. He was a bishop in the 16th century. He's got the same surname as me, and I'm partly reading it to discover about his descendants and whether I might be connected to them. This guy, Latimer, he was most famously burned at the stake by Queen Mary in 1555. And as the flames licked higher, he's quoted as saying to his friend, Nicholas Ridley, who was being burned at the same time, play the man, Master Ridley. We shall this day light such a candle in England by God's grace as I trust shall never be put out. And there are lots of examples like this, including in the Bible, of martyrs going to their deaths resolutely, cheerfully, with their heads held high and often coming up with a really crisp and beautiful statement like that as they do it. And yet if you know the gospel accounts, that is very different. It's actually a stark contrast with Jesus' experience on the night before he died. One of the gospel writers, Luke, who's also a medical doctor, he records the detail that Jesus was in such emotional anguish as he contemplated his death that he started sweating blood all over his body. His capillaries were dilating and just bursting. So a rare stress-induced condition, which medics call hematohydrosis. And he cried out, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Jesus feels like he might be about to die because of the stress. It's just too unbearable. And then he falls on the ground and he prays, if possible, that the hour might pass from him. He's had enough and he's looking for a way out. And it provokes this question, why is it then that, you know, the Christian martyrs, guys like Latimer, were so often so joyful and Jesus so sorrowful? Was Jesus less brave than his followers? Of course, the answer is no. And the reality is that Jesus was facing something far more gruesome than his followers would ever have to endure. And when Jesus prayed on that night, remove this cup from me. The cup Jesus refers to, it's mentioned multiple times in the Bible. It is the cup of God's wrath, God's anger against human sin. John Humphreys, he described the effect, didn't he, that the injustice at Beslan, the massacre of all those children, had on him. That deep sense of anger and injustice. And as our Creator looks down on a world that he made and a world he loves, filled with such injustice and selfishness and hypocrisy, do we really expect him to be any less angry about these things than we are? And of course not. He is rightly angered. He's rightly angered at the ways I've ignored him and lived like I'm God in his world. And the reason Jesus is in such anguish about drinking this cup is that he knows he's been sent, this is his mission, to absorb in himself all of God's righteous anger against our sin. All hell is distilled in this cup, which he has to drink. Its contents are so bitter that just the thought of it makes the Lord of the universe tremble and fall on his face in terror. But of course, he knows that if he doesn't drink this cup, then we, his people, must drink it ourselves. There's a sermon by the 18th century theologian Jonathan Edwards, which continues to have a profound effect on me. And Edwards reflects on this agony on the night before Jesus died like this. Christ was going to be cast into a dreadful furnace of wrath. And it was not proper that he should plunge himself into it blindfold, not knowing how dreadful the furnace was. Therefore, God first brought him and set him at the mouth of the furnace, that he might look in and stand and view its fierce and raging flames. It was as if God were saying, here is the furnace into which you are to be cast. Either your people must perish, or you must endure this for them. And Christ's soul was overwhelmed with the dreadful agony which lay before him, but his love for sinners held out. And so as you and I approach this question today, where is God when life hurts? There's a whole lot of things we don't know. I'm not claiming we can give neat answers to why God permits every instance of human suffering, but we can at least know what the answer isn't. We know it can't be that God doesn't love us. It cannot be that he doesn't care. God so loved us. God so hates suffering. He was willing to come down and endure the worst imaginable suffering in our place. And he did it so that one day he can sort out all suffering for good. So understanding the cross of Jesus Christ is our first essential anchor point as we approach this question of suffering. And it tells us incontrovertibly our God cares. And the second one that we're going to look at today is, and we need to grasp, is the resurrection. And I've put there because the resurrection tells us God will put everything right. So in that fiery furnace passage, the comfort of that passage isn't just that God was with them in the midst of the suffering, but wonderfully, that passage also tells us God will bring his people through the furnace of suffering. It's a wonderful line, isn't it? After Nebuchadnezzar calls the friends out, everyone gathers around them, you know, they're interested, what would they look like? Have they got burn marks? Verse 27, and they discover the hair of their heads was not singed. Their cloaks were not harmed. No smell of fire had come upon them. And these friends have come through the fire completely pristine. They're untouched. They don't even need to get their clothes washed to get rid of that bonfire smell. And the point of this rescue from the fiery furnace, the reason it's in the Bible is not to communicate that this is going to be normal experience for God's people to survive execution attempts. In fact, we know very well it's not. Guys like Hugh Latimer, in fact, plenty of people in the Bible, John the Baptist, Stephen, James, Peter, none of them were rescued from martyrdom. But the promise from this chapter is that for all who trust God, there will be an ultimate rescue through their deaths, beyond the trial. Jesus alludes to actually this bit of Daniel 3, their hair not being singed, in the Gospels, in Luke 21. And he says this rather startling thing to his followers. They're all gathered round. Imagine, you know, Jesus is about to tell you something and you're listening in. And he says this, some of you they will put to death, but not a hair of your head will perish. And this kind of classic Jesus, if you read the Gospels, it's full of these kind of, whoa, no one's ever spoken like that before. Some of you they will put to death, but not a hair of your head will perish. And Jesus confirms in the next statement, he's talking there about a final rescue through God's judgment to be with him forever. That is the sense in which ultimately not a hair of our heads will perish. And actually this image of the fiery furnace, it's used in the Bible not just as a picture of trials, but also as a picture of God's final punishment on sinful people, hell. I've put the reference in the footnote, Matthew 13. The Son of Man, Jesus says, that's him, will send his angels and gather out of his kingdom all lawbreakers and throw them into the fiery furnace. And this passage in Daniel points us forward to the fact that God will ultimately rescue all his people from that furnace of judgment. He will bring us all safely through to be with him forever. If this is the first time you've heard that, you might be thinking it's too good to be true. How can we be sure? And the Bible's resounding and repeated answer to that question is this: the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection is Jesus, is God's stamp of assurance. And it tells us that what Jesus did on the cross really worked, and that God will one day put everything right. The resurrection confirms that the great enemy, death, has been defeated, and that God will sort everything out in the end. And wonderfully, Jesus' resurrection body is described in the Bible as a first fruit. It's a taster, we're told, of what is to come. That's why it's so significant that it was a physical resurrection. The future God promises is not some mere, you know, floaty, abstract, spiritual existence that is just a compensation for the life we've lost. No, Jesus' resurrection declares that there will be a restoration of the life we lost. Jesus speaks in another place of the renewal of all things when he returns, a day when the whole universe will be put right, restored, and perfected and beautified. And actually, this gives us a tremendous resource for joy in the midst of the trial. Janie Erickson Tada, she's an author. She was in an accident when she was 17, and since then she has been quadriplegic, so she's been paralyzed from the neck down. And she's written many times about the difference the resurrection of Jesus has made in her life. She said this: "I, with shriveled, bent fingers, atrophied muscles, gnarled knees, and no feeling from the shoulders down, will one day have a new body, light, bright, and clothed in righteousness, powerful and dazzling. Can you imagine the hope that the resurrection of Jesus Christ gives someone who is spinal cord injured like me?" I don't know what particular challenges are being faced by us in this room at the moment. Maybe there is a situation and somebody is asking even today, where is God when life hurts? What I do know is that the resurrection of Jesus Christ radically changes how we grapple with that question. And if we have these two anchors in place, these anchors that we know for sure God cares, and we know for sure he will put everything right, those anchors mean that whatever the storms bring, even terrible things, we can hang on and even find joy in the midst of them. And that's my prayer for us. I'm going to close actually with a quote from John Knight, who is the guy I described at the beginning when his son was born and he had that period of bitterness. And in the quote, he describes how through these anchors being put in place, he was able to come through this much better. He said, "Through all that's happened, God has continued to remind me of the beauty, sufficiency, and majesty of Jesus Christ and his cross and resurrection. Living with a boy who will always be dependent on someone for all his needs is hard. I have a daily, often hourly, fight for joy in my salvation. Yet through my oldest son's daily care, through my youngest son's premature birth, and now through my wife's ongoing battle with metastatic cancer, God is not just sustaining me, but he's revealing more of his goodness, because he is sovereign over all these things for his glory and my good. So on this day, I'm grateful to Jesus for my real freedom in him and for giving me my boy to help me see it. I was reflecting on the way here, how unlike a rubbish boyfriend God is. You know, the kind of boyfriend who is all talk, but no real commitment. And yet our God is the opposite. He puts down in concrete, publicly attested historical moments, the cross, the resurrection, just how much he loves and how much he is committed to this future. And so we can be sure of it. Why don't I say a prayer, and then we've got 2 minutes, I think, for questions. Father, thank you that you have shown us in these events that you are for us and that you have a final sorting out when suffering will be dealt with. Help us not just to know these things, but to be a comfort to others who need to know them. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.